this week's program, a conversation with Philadelphia Singers music director David Hayes, ahead of the group's revival of Randall Thompson's much underappreciated Requiem. Susan Lewis considers George Gershwin as both the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform one of the great 20th century master's signature works, Rhapsody in Blue. And we take a walk through the Hawaii-themed 2012 Philadelphia Flower Show with Pennsylvania Horticultural Society President Drew Becker. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
A cornerstone of the American choral tradition, Randall Thompson's works have become part of the standard repertoire for choruses both here and abroad. Much of his work was commissioned for amateur or semi-professional ensembles, with texts largely in English and strong, melodic, easily singable tunes. Among his best-known works are The Testament of Freedom, set to several texts by Thomas Jefferson, and Frostiana, which uses seven of Robert Frost's poems as source material. He also wrote an opera, three string quartets, and three symphonies. Thompson also gained much renown as an educator and held positions at various times at the University of California, the Curtis Institute of Music, and the University of Virginia before ending his career at his alma mater, Harvard. What's more surprising is that for a composer who was so influential, arguably his greatest work is also his least performed. Randall Thompson's Requiem received an under-rehearsed premiere in May of 1958 at the University of California, with a subsequent outing the following year at Harvard. Since then, it's been heard only sporadically, with its last performance in 1985, shortly after the composer's death. So when I met with the Philadelphia Singers music director David Hayes earlier this week, I first asked him why such a clearly important work by such a well-renowned composer had failed to enter the mainstream.
There's a lot of reasons why it never entered the mainstream. There's problems with the cost of the score because of the way the layout of the score was. It made it, for the time, well, even for now, pretty expensive. I mean, it's a $44 score. It's a very expensive score.
Why? It's so large?
It has to do with the fact that the work is a 75-minute work, and because of the double choir layout throughout, plus the need for a piano reduction underneath, it required a lot of pages. The publisher couldn't figure out a more efficient way to lay it out. And as a result, you know, the score itself runs to something like 250 pages. It's a huge, big score. In fact, the chorus was concerned as we started rehearsing it because the score is so heavy to actually hold it. So we're going to use music stands because it's just too heavy to hold for 75 minutes. And I suppose there are ways you could break it down and, you know, two parts or something like that. And I think the publisher has considered that in other periods. But it is very expensive because it probably was considered or conceived by Thompson as a work for a large amateur chorus or a collegiate chorus. And that meant that if you're going to do the work, you had to buy probably 80 or 100 or 120 copies of the score. Now, at $44 a piece, that begins to become a prohibitively expensive price point. So there's that factor that plays into why it's not done very often.
And did you guys have to spend that money?
We did. We invested it. I mean, you know, I'm sure much to my board's chagrin, but that's one line item got kind of elevated. But going into it, I knew it was that expensive, and we kind of budgeted for it, and we sort of said, you know, we're going to commit to doing this project, and regardless, we just have to figure out what it's going to take to make it work. So yes, we did pay that. But I'm only using 40 professional singers, so I didn't have to spend the amount of money that a large community chorus or a collegiate ensemble would have to spend to do it. So there's that issue with it. I think that another reason that things conspired against the piece, so to speak, was that almost immediately thereafter, in 1960-61, the premiere of the Requiem was followed right afterwards by the premiere of the Frostiana cycle. And Frostiana is, of course, hugely popular. To this day, hugely popular. It's seven separate octavos. It's a cycle, but each of the works can be excerpted out. And as a result, it became very easy to perform by all kinds of different choruses. And honestly, it sort of overshadowed the Requiem. The Requiem is not easy to excerpt out because the context is lost and you sort of think, well, without that context, it doesn't really make sense. So I think that was another factor that conspired against it. It wasn't easily excerptable. And then probably the last thing, and this is something that we've been noting as we've been rehearsing it, is that 75 minutes a cappella, start to finish, is an awful big sing, even for a professional chorus. It's an awful big sing to maintain an arc of tuning over those large periods of time. And while it looks fairly straightforward on paper, it is fiendishly difficult to maintain the tuning. It requires just really sort of micro adjustments constantly of maintaining and being purely in tune. And over the course of 75 minutes, that gets vocally very tiring. And I think that all of these factors kind of conspired against the success of the piece, even though from a large-scale compositional structure and from the general quality of the writing, I do think, you know, it's a masterpiece. It's a piece that, you know, we throw that word around a lot. But I do believe that this really is one of Thompson's great masterpieces.
But is it just for posterity, or is this truly what we require of requiems, is that they be glorious, right? Is this a glorious piece of music?
I actually think it's a very glorious piece of music. And it's so atypical of what we would think of as a requiem. He chose the title, and other people tried to dissuade him, actually, from using that title. But he was very insistent that he thought that that was the correct title for the piece.
Yeah, it was originally inspired to write it by meeting a terminally ill young man in the late 50s, who, despite the fact that he had months to live, was spending all of his time, you know, interacting with choral music. Is that correct?
Yes, it was a young choral conductor that he encountered in one of his visits somewhere. And this young choral conductor was terminally ill and clearly only had months to live. And despite all of that, Thompson became very fond of this young conductor. And they interacted a lot. There's correspondence between the two of them. And he asked Thompson's advice on all kinds of things. And even though it was clear that he wasn't going to live for more than a few months, he focused on wanting to engage Thompson and learn from Thompson. And Thompson was hugely touched by this. And it really got him thinking about, you know, look, here's this person who's got this terminal illness, and the desire is for the beauty of music. And that's what he wants to think about. He's not thinking about the, you know, I'm about to die. And it caused Thompson to sort of consider the idea of a piece that was about mortality. And I think he purposely avoided creating a liturgical requiem. He did not use any of the traditional requiem texts. It's probably closest akin to the Brahms Requiem in its assembly of texts that, in some ways, in the case of the Brahms, it's about the people who are left behind more so than the person who has passed away. In the case of the Thompson, he put together a piece that essentially is a dialogue between the souls of the departed and the mourners who are left behind. And at the beginning of the work, the two camps, if you will, are sort of completely at odds with each other. The souls of the departed have no understanding. They don't understand why the mourners are so unhappy and their lamentations and why they're grieving so much. To them, this is nothing bad. But the people who are grieving and who are mourning don't understand that. They haven't quite elevated themselves into a more spiritual realm. And so he created this sort of journey, this arc of the nature of grieving and the nature of mourning and death and what it means.
And how to reconcile.
Exactly. And how to reconcile one's grief and mourning with this fact that we all have to. In fact, there's one line at the very beginning of the dialogue that basically says, yeah, that's all great and well for you to say this to us. You know, it's lovely living in the spiritual realm, but we all die. You know, we perish. And then very calmly, the spirits say, but yes, but have you no faith? Of course it's okay. We are the embodiment of it's okay. And little by little, these arguments go back and forth, and they come to a real philosophic meeting in the middle of the piece. It's extraordinary, the construct, actually, from a libretto standpoint, if you want to think about it.
But an incredibly American. this idea of everything's going to be okay. I mean, it's not something Brahms or Mozart was ever trying to convince us of.
Well, it's that there's that American idea of it's going to be okay. In the end, it will be okay. But it's also, in a way, it's uniquely American because there's a debate. These two sides are actually debating two different perspectives of this idea of eternal life. And eventually, the debate subsides because one side has convinced the other side that they should be thinking in a different way. And there's a kind of a uniquely democratic sort of, you know, both sides
reaching across the aisle ecclesiastically.
I mean, literally across the Great Divide. So it's uniquely American in that sense. I mean, that's not something that a European composer would ever come up with in that sense. And so I think it is appropriate to sort of say that this is a uniquely American requiem.
Philadelphia Singers music director David Hayes. The Singers perform Randall Thompson's Requiem this evening at 8 at the Church of the Holy Trinity in Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. There's a pre-concert conversation at 7 at the Curtis Institute of Music.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
In the first part of the 20th century, George Gershwin found fortune as a composer of popular songs, which were used in dozens of Broadway and Hollywood musicals, many of which he created with his brother, lyricist Ira Gershwin. But he also made his mark on the classical world with, among other works, many solo pieces for piano, the great American opera Porgy and Bess, and a number of classic orchestral works. Although George Gershwin died in 1937 at age 38, his music has lived on in films and TV soundtracks, in revivals of his musicals, and in new stage productions. The latest example, Nice Work If You Can Get It, starring Matthew Broderick, is set to open on Broadway at the end of this month. His signature orchestral work, Rhapsody in Blue, is performed by orchestras throughout the world. The New Jersey Symphony is performing it this weekend. The Philadelphia Orchestra is playing it in a program beginning Thursday. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis considers George Gershwin and his musical legacy.
Backstage at the Kimmel Center, Philadelphia Orchestra principal clarinet Ricardo Morales played the opening of Rhapsody in Blue.
I had to try to think of being free and try to have a lot of spirit and fun with it, because that's basically how the glissando even came to being.
He says during the rehearsal of that first performance of Gershwin's 1924 work, the clarinet player was having some fun with the opening scale. The composer liked it and wrote that glissando, gliding from note to note, into the score.
From a joking manner in the rehearsal, it just became like the standard way of playing the piece.
Musical exploration, after all, prompted the entire work's birth. Bandleader Paul Whiteman had asked the 25-year-old Gershwin to compose a concerto for a concert which was to be a musical experiment, says Temple Associate Professor of Music Ted Latham.
The idea was, how far could you push a concert band, a jazz band, in terms of breaking into the classical world? And Gershwin's piece was the linchpin for the whole thing.
Conceived on a train ride from New York to Boston as a musical kaleidoscope of America, created in about 4 weeks, the work emerged from Gershwin as a free-flowing, one-movement rhapsody. Within this classically recognized form, Gershwin developed several themes, as a conventional classical work would do, but also used harmonies and rhythms reminiscent of jazz.
I played this for one of my teachers, and he said to me, "Michelle, this isn't Chopin."
Curtis student Michelle Kahn, who is performing the work with the New Jersey Symphony this weekend, says making a detailed written score sound like an improvised art form like jazz is not easy.
There's tempo changes everywhere. Almost every couple measures, he writes in, "I want the tempo to get faster here. I want there to be a retard here," which means to slow down, and then suddenly go back to tempo. And I mean, it's so many instructions in a way that makes me look at it methodically. But yet, you have to find a balance, because if you think only methodically, then you lose a lot, really. You lose the charm. You lose what jazz is.
An example?
It goes from this forte, big orchestral, you know, proclamation to this little dance. I mean, he He's kind of joking with you. You know? And he actually asks you to slow down. And the listener is, oh, what's about to happen, you know? Is this going to be one of those very mellow moments now? You know, he set us up for that. But then suddenly he picks up speed again.
The key to making the work sound improvised, says the Philadelphia Orchestra's Ricardo Morales, is compromise and flexibility.
That is basically the trick on all good music, which is that there are a lot of things that Gershwin does, also Bartok, and there are many markings that seem extreme, and the page and the score looks extremely busy, but it's in Mahler also, there's a million things that are going on and very many specific markings in terms of color, tempo, style, yet it's meant to be so that then it has a very natural flow to it.
Many critics didn't know what to make of the experiment bridging the separate musical worlds of jazz and classical, says Temple's Ted Latham.
The popular critics said, well, it's too stuffy. And the classical critics said, well, it's, you know, sort of a hack piece. And the classical critics were responding to this music that sounded too jaunty, too easy, too much fun.
And yet?
It's really the work that put him on the map as a classical composer. Up until then, he was known as a Broadway composer and a Tin Pan Alley songwriter.
A successful Broadway composer who had gotten a job at 15 on New York's Tin Pan Alley, a section of 28th Street between 5th Avenue and Broadway, home of major music publishers and the place where songs were written and banged out on old pianos by song pluggers like the young George Gershwin. The second of four children, Jacob Gershwin, born in Brooklyn in 1898, was called George by his family. He later changed the family name to Gershwin. Growing up on the streets of New York when jazz was also on the rise, George took eagerly to the piano his parents had purchased for his older brother Ira. With a gift for lyric melody, he became successful early, writing song after song. His first big hit, 1919's Swanee.
Swanee.
Once he had commercial success, which came to him relatively easily through his songwriting, he wanted critical success. He wanted acclaim. He wanted to be considered a serious composer.
Lacking formal training, he sought lessons from composers Nadia Boulanger, Maurice Ravel, and Arnold Schoenberg, each of whom turned him down.
All of them said, "You're a great composer already. Why mess with what you have going?" They saw the potential in him to merge these classical and popular genres.
From the early 20s, Gershwin composed dozens and dozens of songs and multiple works in different genres. In 1924, the same year he wrote Rhapsody in Blue, he began working on popular tunes almost exclusively with his brother Ira, who had become a lyricist. The musical Lady Be Good was the first of a string of Broadway shows he did with Ira at the rate of one or two a year into the early 1930s. Among them, Funny Face and Strike Up the Band in 1927, Showgirl in 1929, Girl Crazy in 1930, and Of Thee I Sing in 1931. For orchestras, he wrote his piano concerto in F in 1925, and in 1928, An American in Paris, which became the inspiration for the 1951 MGM film.
That piece has a great deal of elements that are very much in the French school of writing in terms of having very precise orchestration and a great deal of different colors by mixing different sections of the orchestra, winds and strings or brass and winds, etc. And it is really magnificent. It's such a fun piece, you always feel like you just want to give it your all, and actually it's a bit of a dangerous part because you have to really balance all the intricate things, because there's many things that happen very quickly and one has to obey much more the orchestral markings, the dynamic markings, etc., for the textures to come out.
Second Rhapsody premiered in 1931, Cuban Overture in 1932. In 1936, he wrote Catfish Row for orchestra and the film score for Shall We Dance, only a year after the opening of his opera, Porgy and Bess, about African-American life on the South Carolina coast. Soprano Karen Slack has sung the work with the Opera Company of Philadelphia under artistic director Robert Driver.
It is absolutely the best-known American opera.
The music is black music, but it's also just jazz, and it makes you feel like you're not separated. You know, sometimes the Italian music, the French music, the German music is like, it's not our culture as Americans. Forget color. It's about our history as Americans.
Not only did his works range from pop, jazz, classical, and opera, individual pieces transcended all genres. In 1937, while working in Hollywood, Gershwin collapsed from a brain tumor and died after surgery. In pictures, George Gershwin appears as easygoing and natural as his music, flushed with success rather than struggle.
But these stories about him constantly improving his craft, seeking out new teachers, even if he was rejected, trying to learn orchestration, really give you a different picture of someone who was very consciously honing his craft and working hard at it.
Gershwin is one of those that the more one gets to see, there's more and more layers to the work that he does. He's really one of our American geniuses, for sure.
What's very exciting to me is that I'll speak to friends of mine that aren't in the musical world about concerts that I'm playing. When I say I'm about to play Rhapsody in Blue, oh my goodness, I mean young and old and everyone, oh, I know that piece. And people, they get so excited when they actually know the piece.
Music where the serious and whimsical can meet and where the difficult looks easy. Perhaps Gershwin's greatest legacy is his gift of so many melodies in whatever context that reach across time.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Michelle Kahn plays Rhapsody in Blue with the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra tonight in Red Bank and tomorrow in Englewood in concerts led by John Morris Russell. From Thursday through Saturday, James Gaffigan will conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra in a program featuring Rhapsody in Blue with pianist Stuart Goodyear. So our next item this morning takes us out of the studio and to the Pennsylvania Convention Center in Center City, Philadelphia. We're here with the president of the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society, Drew Becker. Hawaii this year, and the first show that I think that you've been involved in, Soup to Nuts. When you arrived, the other one was last year was in the planning stage, right?
Last year was in planning stage. Actually, this year was in planning stage as well. The theme was already picked and a lot of stuff was already done. Next year will be the first show for basically Soup to Nuts. We plan way in advance. I mean, doing anything this big, you know, takes a lot of planning. We're basically now focused on 2013 and putting that show together. So it's exciting.
Of course, you know, Hawaii, a tropical climate, not a challenge for this flower show because it's held indoors. What were the special challenges, if any, of choosing that particular ecology as the theme for this year's show?
Well, I think one of the things that that we focused on, it was about the horticulture. We wanted to highlight the horticulture. I mean, this region, we have about a $2 billion horticultural industry from Waldorf Orchids, who our main orchid provider, one of the main orchid providers actually for the country, is in this region. And also Delaware Valley Floral Wholesale, 25% of America's cut floral comes through them. So we wanted to highlight those folks, but really it was about to highlight just the fascinating aspect of Hawaii. I mean, a lot of people, when you think of Hawaii, you know, they're like tiki huts and that type of stuff. And what we wanted to really focus on was the actual in-depth culture of Hawaii and just what a unique place it is in America. So, and I think people will see that when they enter. I mean, the show this year is completely changed. The floor plan is the first time the floor plan as a wholesale changed since like 1996. people are going to be, we call it the great equalizer. Everybody that's been here for years and years and years is having to relearn where everything is. So I think that's going to be fun. And, you know, you go to a new exotic land and you get lost. And that's what we want people to have happen here, is get lost at the flower show for a couple hours and have some fun.
What a lot of people don't see, but would be perhaps aware of, is that this is really the central fundraiser for the Horticultural Society and for all of the other programs you do. You've put several in place since you arrived 18 months ago. What are they, and how have those been going?
Yeah, the one that we're really focusing on with the flower show that we're raising funds for is our City Harvest Program. And the City Harvest Program is a unique program because we really focused on how do we get this food that we grow in our community gardens out to the people in need. So one of the things that we do is we've raised and propagated plants and trained about 575 prisoners from the Philadelphia prison system to propagate plants and greenhouse management. And then those plants go out to our community gardens where we've raised 160,000 pounds of fresh organic produce that goes to feed over 1,000 families per week during the growing season. USDA has taken notice of this, and so has Pew. They have funded an expansion of this program. We're very, very excited about that. And anybody that grows tomato plants or any vegetables in their yard knows that, you know, one tomato plant, you have, you know, more tomatoes than you know what to do with by the end of the summer. So the focus was its distribution system, and we've partnered with Share, which gets this out to the food cupboard. So we're very excited about where that program's going. And then last year, we softly launched the Plant 1 Million campaign here.
Which is an echo of something you were involved in New York as well, right?
Yeah, it was. It's a take on the million trees from New York. But what we did here was we focused on the region. And it's something that the U.S. Forest Service really wanted us to focus on. And because they were focused that each of these government entities all over the country are doing these tree planting campaign, but nobody's looking regional. And that's something that we wanted to focus on here. So it's three states, 13 counties. It's the largest multi-state, multi-county tree planting effort in the country. 300,000 trees in Philadelphia, and then 700,000 in the 12 other counties. And I'm happy to report that this last year and 2 months, we planted over 138,000 trees with our partners throughout the region. So I think we're more comfortable that we're going to be able to make the numbers, and we're going to be announcing this big time this spring with a couple of Philly favorites, including the Phillies.
And these trees are being planted to replace trees, or is this new planting? What's the goal of all of this? It's
actually both. There's not a comprehensive tree replacement strategy anywhere. So it's people cutting down trees. It's alarming if you look at the satellite imagery from basically 1990 to now, and you see the region tree canopy disappearing. You know, we have the real estate market on our side now. But you know, if you remember in the go-go years of the last decade, where housing was just seemed endless. You know that these housing developments were going up, and they clear-cut property and stuff like that. So we've got that on our side, but a lot of it is replacement. We really haven't had a coordinated tree planting effort for many, many years in a lot of the places we're looking at. And we're focused on a lot of the old commerce centers, such as Chester, Norristown, Reading, Philadelphia. And these areas have really low tree canopy coverage and in turn have high asthma rates, the terrible stormwater management issues. So the correlation goes hand in hand.
And how important is your role in educating the public about all of these things that trees or the lack thereof do?
Well, I think our role, that's one of the essential roles, is we need to educate folks on the importance of trees. I think everyone knows that trees are, quote, good, but they might not know all of the ways that they are. And, it's not all about us planting trees. It's about private citizens doing it as well. And if people plant a tree, all they have to do is log on to plant1million.org, click I planted a tree, and fill the form out. It takes like 2 seconds, and you'll get an email back, thanks for being one in a million, and your tree has been counted in the plan. So all these trees are not going to be planted on streets and parks and public property. It's actually, most of the region is owned by private individuals, and we need them to plant those trees as well.
So that's the push for the next year, besides planning the next year's flower show.
Exactly.
Pennsylvania Horticultural Society President Drew Becker. The 2012 Philadelphia Flower Show opens tomorrow at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in Philadelphia and runs through Sunday, March 11th. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.